Hello and welcome to the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks with me, Mark Wade. Today I'm delighted to have Jonathan Norman from Y-Prime. Jonathan is Director of Translation and Localization and Scales at Y-Prime. Jonathan, welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me.
Now, full disclosure, Jonathan and I know each other a long time, and I think we're going to make a lot of enemies today, Jonathan. We're going to be very controversial, aren't we?
Potentially, yeah.
Okay, so Jonathan and I are going to talk about libraries, and it's a bit of a bugbear for me because as a language provider, we get asked constantly about libraries and where we can store assets and all that good stuff. And if I'm being honest, a lot of the time the ECUA providers, whom I work with, all of them, will think or verbalize that this is the panacea. And my humble opinion is that it's not the panacea. So Jonathan, where do you land on libraries?
I think, you know, it's a really hot topic in the industry and it has been for quite a while now. And I think it is something that a lot of sponsors approach an eco provider expecting them to have, right? This really robust library full of questionnaires and languages that can just be kind of taken and plugged into a system. And I think that it is actually a spectrum of efficiency that we really need to look at. In some cases, leveraging libraries is really easy and it's a real benefit to the program. In other instances, it's not as effective as we might think it is. And, you know, I think that there's a lot to dive into on this particular topic by understanding exactly how they should be used, when they should be used, and ultimately what we refer to them as.
Interesting. So, Jonathan, I like what you're saying. I really want to unpack, though, this nomenclature that we use, libraries. I think it's a misnomer. So can we define it first and foremost?
I think we definitely can. And I think this is part of the problem. I mean, the word libraries become part of the vernacular that we use every day when talking about the world of eCore. So I don't think the word itself is going anywhere, but we have to be clearer as an industry about what we mean by it. And I think the problem with the word library is that it gives you this image of walking into like a public library, you know, where you walk in and you have shelves of books or whatever content you might want. You can take it off the shelf and you can then just walk out the door with it. And it is that easy. However, that doesn't translate well to what we're actually asked to do within clinical trials. I mean, if you think about comparing the work we do to books in a library, for one, you know, books, they are unchangeable. They are what they are. You can't make a change to a book. You can't walk into a library and say, I want this book, but I want to change the ending, please. You know, you kind of get what you have. And additionally, books are kind of read in isolation. You read a book, you close that book, you open the next one and you read that one. But in eCore, we actually are delivering one package, which is an amalgamation of all the content. I think a better way to look at it is like going into a publishing house, where really what you want to do is make your own anthology of work. You go in, you choose the stories that you want to include. And yes, they're already written. And yes, they may even already be printed on paper. But what you're doing is you're asking someone to take those stories, those bits of content, and to marry them together, to bind them into a nice book that you then walk out with. So it's that bespoke combination element, which means that libraries aren't just something that you walk into in the eCore world and take out a fully built study ready to go.
I think, seriously, I mean, because every single day I get this, like, we have a library or we're building a library and it's just going to be like going into our local library and I take out a book. And I get this every single day, that this is the panacea, this is going to expedite the process. And there's no doubt about it in my world that we can reuse assets. We've been reusing language assets forever in the language world. You make a really good point, but walk me through, and I've got a couple of scenarios, walk me through where it is useful to have a, by the way, what word are we landing on? Do we have to land on library or can we land on a different word?
I'm just curious. Yeah, I think we could call it lots of things. We could call it an asset repository. We could talk about leveraging content. You know, there's lots of ways we can name it. But I do think that the word library is out there. And I think that holding on to it. Yeah.
Well, you know what then? You've heard it today. You heard it on Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. We are renaming libraries to asset repositories. Okay. I'm serious because I get so frustrated. I get so frustrated when I get like, oh, you have a library for this. You've already translated this instrument. Therefore, just pull it off the shelf. Just pull it off the shelf and that's it. And that's not the case. Can you give me a scenario where you find it useful to have those assets in this repository?
Yeah. Definitely. And I think
I'm getting used to it now.
What I don't want to do is, you know, poo-poo the idea of content reuse or libraries, you know, completely, because they definitely have their place. I mean, it's hard to deny that taking a body of code, which has previously been approved, and applying it to a study is significantly faster than writing that code or creating that questionnaire from scratch. The difference is that it's not going to bring the immediacy that people seem to expect it will, because there's still all the work around it that needs to happen. The other part that goes into this as well is if you think about the translation space, right, an area where both our organizations really intersect, that we know that when you're migrating content into a system, it's an opportunity for error to be introduced. And if that content's been migrated once and the effort's been put in to validate it and to sign off on it by a linguist, then just reusing that content removes a part of the process where error can be introduced. So it definitely has a quality aspect to it as well. I think another area where we can really look at leveraging content that we've stored and previously approved is getting through that first hurdle of ethics committees and IRB submissions, because what they want to see is the way in which the questionnaire will be displayed to the patient and all the wording that's going to be included. And so they're not looking at the project and seeing, have you done this, quote unquote, correctly? Have you done this in a way which is going to guarantee the quality of the build you put in front of the patient? They're looking at this to say, is the intended content that the patient is going to see acceptable, ethical, all those things? And therefore, screen reports from a library that accurately represent the final content the patients will see arguably are perfectly suitable materials for that. And then it just comes down to the translation provider, the core provider, to work together to make sure that the final build that is pushed to the patients is an exact replica of what was submitted to the ethics committee. And if you're reusing content, that's significantly easier.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly it. I mean, there are, I'm going to outline three different scenarios. This came up in the podcast before in a different episode, which was worthwhile listening to, but it was with a sponsor. And we talked about how the three scenarios that they deal with every single day. And one is they use an instrument that is previously translated, the translation is available, all that good stuff. Then another one that is only partially, or they don't have a couple of languages. Let's say they have 18 languages. They have 9 of them, but they don't have 9. And then they have a de novo instrument that they've either created themselves or it's never been. And the challenge they faced was often the powers that be think, oh gosh, it's still going to be this amount of time, but it's going to be this amount of time because of this de novo instrument. It's going to be this amount of time because the translations don't exist. So the whole benefit of the library, the asset repository, was almost nullified. And that was their biggest bugbear. Do you agree with that? Because you have, when we talked before, there were two scenarios you talked about that were like the unicorn scenarios, you know?
Yeah.
What are they?
Yeah.
What are they now?
So I think that, you know, you have an idea of a study, right? Which could be where it is only questionnaires and only languages where you have already done that in the past, right? As a standalone build of those questionnaires in those languages altogether. And so that's an example where you could say where you're repeating that study. And so we want to use it exactly as we did without any changes whatsoever. Then that is an example of a study where you could 100% check it out, do the necessary checks you have to do, then push it out of the door. But it's right to call that the unicorn, because it is very rare in my experience that you work from one study team to the next where there are zero requests for customization. And now sometimes these are things which are value add, you know, they've identified an issue in the previous study, or they've had feedback from the FDA, or, you know, it could be any reason why they want to then change the words on the screen, anything like that. And, you know, that needs to be done. On the other side of things, you get the kind of changes which don't really bring value. You get customizations to instructions, like to add the word please into instructions to make them seem more polite. And of course, that has a major impact on the translation process. And you have to go through a whole process to update those strings, arguably for something that doesn't bring value to patients. And so I think it's really important to look at the way that we design our studies, set up our studies, so that we are identifying where we can leverage as much as we can, and we are minimizing the changes we ask for to only those which actually further the science or bring a better experience to patients.
We're on the same page, because people say to me, oh, it's a library, that nothing changes. But the reality is, in the real world, things do change. Yeah. And I think that's a great example of the core language, which is like not part of the string, it's part of the instructions. They change one word, but that might have to be translated to 18 languages.
Yeah.
Is a great example.
Yeah.
So there is that kind of like, I like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said unicorns are rare. I'm going to put your feet to the fire.
Okay.
Okay. How rare do you think it is? It happens 5 in 10 studies. It happens 2 in 10. Where would you land? Or is that, can you quantify it?
Oh, that's a really tough question. What I would say is that it is very rare, very rare. And I would even, maybe not in 10, I would say maybe 1 in 20, 1 in 25 studies has exactly the same questionnaires in exactly the same languages as a previous study that can then just be, you know, fully reused and recycled into another study. But don't forget, there's the back end of questionnaires, you know, which is just as important as the front end often. You know, it's how does it take the data? What does it do with the data? Is that stored in the library with the questionnaire, or is it a separate element? And so there's a lot that goes into this decision, not just what's on the front, but by virtue of the fact that different studies are going to be testing for different things, maybe asking different questions, needing customizations to make them appropriate for the adapted patient population, it's not an industry that lends itself well to full projects being identical. And now we do see the same questionnaires over and over again, but they're put together in different combinations. And so that's the thing that I want to make sure I'm really clear on my message here, is I'm not saying that reusing the content is a worthless endeavor. It is not a worthless endeavor. It absolutely does save us time, just not maybe as much time as people expect it to when they are looking at this and saying, okay, I'm kicking off today. I want my study finished by tomorrow, because you should have all of this in your library. It's much more nuanced than that.
And I think it all stems from the description. It all stems from this library word, where we just assume that nothing changes. In the real world, nothing changes. We have this translation already available, and we're going to migrate to an ECOA modality, and there's an IRB involved. But unfortunately, there is this, I don't know how to describe this, but in my experience, there's this appetite that people want, they want it to be a unicorn, and so therefore they're willing to accept it because it agrees with their bias, excuse the pun. But I get it all the time. And in my experience, I have ECOA providers, no, not dissing them, but their attitude is like, why can't you have this done faster? You translated this before. We have those assets. I'm saying, yes, but things change. It's not exactly the same.
Yeah.
I want to ask you another question, if I may, and we haven't talked about this, but I'm curious about your opinion. And maybe you don't want to answer this, but each ECOA provider has different IT architecture, different topology, different topography.
Yeah.
If we have a library, sorry, a data repository, asset repository for certain instruments, right? And we have it on one ECOA called ABC ECOA provider and XYZ over here. They might store those libraries differently because they're going to migrate them differently.
Yeah.
So a sponsor will say, well, you already translated that before, you've already migrated that before. No, we haven't. No, we haven't done it for XYZ. We did it for ABC, but not for XYZ. So it doesn't actually exist. Do you agree with any of that?
I think that the thing to really keep in mind is, like, as you're saying, the architecture of the core provider is a really important part of what the patient sees. Although it's not visible to them, if you imagine the files that we're working in to put the translations into, there are lots of elements in there which control not only how the text appears and displays on the screen, but also how that text connects to other elements of the system. And now, you know, you do hear people say, well, why can't I take the files from ECO Provider 1 and just use them with ECO Provider 2? And it is because those architectures are completely different. And now, can we imagine a world in which everyone has exactly the same architecture? I mean, you
no.
can imagine it, but I don't think you're going to get there, because realistically, then what you're asking every core provider to do is have exactly the same system, in which case then you have no difference between them, and then you don't have an industry, you don't have separate providers. But I think that, you know, it's important to keep in mind that the text has to go into an environment, it has to be held within a file. And I think of it like egg cups, right? The words of the language are the eggs, and the egg cups are what hold that language. And that's the strings of text, okay? And you have to think about putting the text into different egg cups in a different structure of egg cups every time you do it. And so it's not the eggs that are the problem. You've got the eggs, and it's not the egg cups that are a problem, because they're their own item. It's putting them together each time is what can make the difference from one text to the next, when you actually put it into the system and then have to do all the quality control work.
Yeah, and just to add to that, and I've written about this, the egg cups are not a universal size. They're different sizes. So I've written about this, and we talked about, like, the data standards. Like, simply this, the way, as a language provider, we receive files from ECOA providers. The way we receive text and files is very different to every single provider. There's a myriad of different ways. Yeah. And that in itself gives us different size egg cups. Yeah. I like the analogy.
Yeah.
So I think we're on the same page. We both agree our ASCII repositories are very useful. There's no doubt about it. It does help. Unicorns are not as common as one thinks.
Yeah.
Not that unicorns by definition are one of our unicorns, but it's not as common as one thinks. But if you have assets, they can be reused and it can impact on the timelines.
Yes.
I think the caveat that I'm hearing here, and tell me if I'm wrong here, the caveat or the advice that I'm hearing here is don't rely on it to be like taking out a book from a library. It's not. It's going to reduce our timelines, but it's not going to be the panacea.
It's understanding the bigger picture. And that's a thing we lose sight of, right? It's the trial design is so much more than just the display of questionnaires on the screen. And so while, yes, we should store work that we've done in the past, where we're allowed to, where we have the agreements in place, kind of all that stuff that goes with it. But presuming that is in place, being able to store content and reuse it does absolutely bring quality improvements and it brings timeline improvements to the project. But it's just remembering that actually you've got to look at it on a questionnaire by questionnaire basis or an asset by asset basis, rather than assuming the entire study as a package is the asset. It's not. That's a sum of the assets. And that's the thing to keep in mind. And the other thing to throw in with it is change isn't always bad, right? So we talk a lot about libraries and we talk about the need for standardization. We talk about the need for people to not ask for changes. And that is what you need to leverage an asset repository or a library as effectively as you can. But what I personally wouldn't like is that we end up at a point in the industry where we are adverse to improvements, either to our scales, either to the translations, whatever it might be, because we are worried about undoing the efficacy of libraries. So I wouldn't want us to live with a mistake or to avoid a change which could make things better for a patient because we don't want to take the extra time to develop the study. And now I know there is a very careful balance, right, between study timelines and the data and the patient experience. But an area that I think about is accessibility, an area which is always growing. And we're learning all the time about what is better for patients, particularly with certain conditions. I'll give you a really simple example that someone said to me the other day, and I didn't know this, and it kind of blew my mind when I think about the work that we do, is that combining bold and underline on a word apparently is a nightmare for people who have visual impairment issues. That's not a good way to do it. And so the advice from an accessibility standpoint is to not do that. But if we think about how many questionnaires out there that are validated, that have been used for years, that are standard, include both bold and underline on words, it is everywhere. And so for us to turn around tomorrow and say, we're not going to do that, there's a lot of resistance to that because you have to reflect it in ECOA because it's part of the validated questionnaire. And also we have to make sure that as an industry, we're not holding ourselves back because we are afraid of making those changes. We just have to recognize that we can't make something today in 2025 and expect that that's going to be the only way it's ever going to be produced for the next 20, 30, 40 years. We have to be open to change and what that means for our studies and our timelines. But we also have to be sensible and not make changes we don't have to make so that we can get the efficiencies where we can.
I consider that part of our evolution. I mean, I've been doing this long enough. When we started off doing ePro, it was called ePro then, and we were programming Palm Pilots and HP handheld computers, putting instruments on it. I mean, we've evolved an awful lot. I mean, and I still think here we are in 2025 and there's an awful lot to go. You make a very good point though. I'm going to end it there, Jonathan. This has been fantastic. I really enjoyed this. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today. Today I was joined by Jonathan Nolan. He's Director of Localization and Translation and Scale Management at Y-Prime. Please subscribe to Transperfect Lifestyle Talks with me, Mark Wade, your host. And if you want to come on the podcast, email us at the link below, lifestyletalks@transperfect.com. Thanks a lot. We're on all the streaming platforms. Bye-bye.